Good evening. We are once again joined by Stephen Singular, the author of Legacy of Deception, Investigation of Mark Furman and Racism in the LAPD, published in softcover by Dove Books. Stephen, welcome back once again to our airwaves.
Thank you for having me.
We've been speaking about some of the allegations concerning a possible white supremacist connections of Mark Furman, and you mentioned that a researcher named Donald Freed, a name well known to the veteran audience to this program, is going to be coming out with a forthcoming book this fall about that. Please fill us in on that.
The book is called Killing Time, and it's published by Macmillan, and it will be out in, I think, late August or early September. And Donald Freed and another gentleman, I believe, are the primary authors of the book, but he had three or four people working with him and was able to do a lot of things I couldn't. He lives in Los Angeles, and as I said, he had a staff working on his behalf. One of the interesting things that Mr. Freed has done is to take computer experts and essentially use computer timelines to sort of take the available time for this crime. In other words, if we went from, say, 5 minutes after 10, let's say, on the night of June 12, 1994, until about 5 minutes till 11, when the limo driver sees O.J. there, and he does some very, very interesting things with the time, and what he basically demonstrates through experiments and through evidence and through corroborating testimony from a variety of sources is essentially showing you that these crimes were committed later than the prosecution says they were, and there simply was never enough time for Simpson to do it. And I think he makes a very, very strong case for that. But even the prosecution in their own case, as we know from watching the trial, I mean, they started out by saying a dog barked at 10:15, so that's when the crimes were committed. By the end of the case, based upon the testimony of people like Robert Heitstra, who heard things at 10:35 and 10:40 while walking his dog, they had moved back the timeline considerably, back to 10:30, 10:35. I don't know how you kill two people, get rid of all the evidence, get rid of all the bloody clothing, take a ride home, get rid of everything, get in the house, take a shower, clean up, and get in the limousine. I don't know how you do it in 15 minutes.
Well, you know, Stephen, as I'm thinking about the delineation of evidence in your book, there was one question that I had, and if I understand your book correctly, I believe it also was something of a, or at least at the time of your writing, was something of a question mark in your mind. In examining the Rockingham, Bundy is where Nicole lived, correct? And Rockingham
correct.
Is O.J.'s estate.
Correct.
In examining the actual crime scene, you came across a broken lathe in a picket fence adjoining a storage area, part of a storage area adjoining Nicole's property. Did that have any relation to the stick that was
found? I don't believe that it did. I mean, I was just there trying to, you know, do the best I could, as I said earlier. But the point I was basically making was that I was there and I was doing a lot of snooping around and I was checking out fences for where it had been broken. And as I write about in the book, and as I really think is somewhat germane to what we're talking about, was I was at the crime scene three or four times on my own, looking around, doing my own investigation. And what I always felt when I was there was this enormous sense of irony about this entire case, that it's probably the most publicized crime in American history, that or probably a Kennedy assassination, but the media had really never focused on anything, I don't think, for this long with this intensity. And I don't think we know anything about this case. I don't think, I felt that standing there, I feel it today. I don't think we yet know what happened in this case.
Indeed. One of the things that's interesting about the O.J. Simpson case is that it has been, and I cite again the quote from Edith Wharton, that a frivolous society can only achieve dramatic significance through what its frivolity destroys. Certainly there has been an awful lot of media coverage, and excessive and perhaps obsessive media coverage of the O.J. Simpson case. There has been an awful lot of bad humor, much of it quite sick, about this case. And yet I think this is one of the most profound political events in recent memory. It has, I think, enormous, incalculably great political overtones. I wonder if I could ask you perhaps to ruminate on that a bit.
Well, I think what happened to me during the case is that You know, as I said earlier, in 1984, I started writing a book about white supremacists who killed a Jewish talk show host in Denver. And what I mean by saying that is that I'm not a person who is that naive about racial issues. I mean, I had been pretty close to some pretty ugly things back then and have written about racial issues and thought about them. And, you know, feel that I am relatively sophisticated. I entered the Simpson case trying to get something done, trying to find out what was in blood and answering what I thought were some very serious and very significant questions to see what really happened. I'm white, and I approached and dealt with many different white journalists working for major media organizations, the New York Times, the LA Times, NBC, ABC, CBS, CNN, right on down the line. I could not find one white person in the media, the major media organizations of the United States, who would listen to any information that ran contrary to the canned version of what happened in this case. It was inconceivable to these people that police plant evidence. It was inconceivable that they would do that by racial motivation. It was inconceivable that O.J. Simpson was innocent. I mean, it was a loss of innocence for me. And as I said, I don't think I was starting from a point of great naivety, but I was simply astonished at the difference in the perceptions of police behavior. And I think for any white American, that's what this case is all about. It's about realizing that there is an enormous fear factor out there, that enormous underlying racial fear in our society, that I think white people, I think the white media, I think the major media outlet organizations, highly predominantly white, were allowed to give vent to that fear in this particular case. A black man killed a white woman. That was the standard interpretation from day one. Forget the fact that it came from somebody who psychologically disturbed, by his own admission, 15 years earlier in a psychiatric report said, I'm not fit to be on the streets. I can't stand African-Americans or Hispanic people. I don't belong here. This is the person who was conducting the investigation. This is the person who was creating the information that was fed to our media. This is what our media was swallowing. They could not conceive of the fact that police could abuse racial minorities. That is the most significant thing in this case to me. And it shows you that the difference in our experience and the difference in our perceptions remains so wide and so disturbing that, you know, if we don't start to do something about it, we're just going to suffer more. And the most disturbing thing about this case to me is that, I mean, I remain to this day, I can't get most white people to even consider these ideas.
It was not a pleasant experience. I was deeply skeptical that O.J. Simpson could have done this, simply because in thinking about the physical circumstances, it didn't make sense that a single individual could have done this.
But the point is that the media doesn't deal in physical circumstances.
Oh,
it deals
absolutely.
It deals in unconscious emotional responses. There is enormous fear of black people. There is enormous fear of the black male. You throw that image up in front of people, and then you darken it, as Time magazine did, and then you make it look more sinister. It has nothing to do with rationality or evidence or physical circumstances or blood or EDTA or anything else. It's pushing deep buttons in people, and they can be manipulated with a handful of words and images. That's what's disturbing about this case.
One of the things that I noted right after O.J. was arrested, that in its apparent external parameters, this case corresponded to a T to the oldest and most pejorative racist stereotype in this country's political and cultural history, that of the hyper-libidinous, hyper-aggressive black male lusting after and destroying the white female. This is a tremendously powerful racist image in our culture and our history. One need only think about the legion of lynchings that has taken place in connection with this. More publicized cases such as the Scottsboro or Martinsville cases in which black men were accused of raping white women. These were quite celebrated cases. And even though we consider ourselves far more sophisticated now as a people than we were in those days, yet perhaps, as William Faulkner said, the past is never dead and buried. It isn't even past.
No. Well, I think that's what you saw here, just simply come out. You know, I mean, we would like to think all of these things about ourselves, but the fear is right there beneath the surface, and everything that happened in this case triggered and brought to the surface those very basic fears, and we just haven't dealt with them as a society.
You noted the particular significance of, quote, race mixing, unquote, for white supremacists who may figure in the background or even foreground of this case. Certainly that was one of the reasons your source contacted you as opposed to some author or other author because of your background looking into the murder of Alan Berg in connection with your previous book. We might want to note in passing, too, that Louis Beam, the author of The Leaderless Resistance Strategy, which has come into the focus of the media in the wake of Oklahoma City, along with some other Aryan Nations people, owned a bunch of property up in Sandpoint, which proves nothing. There's also an Identity Christianity cell up there headed up by a fellow who I believe his name is Barwell. I may be wrong on the name as I'm operating from memory.
Richard Butler.
Well, Richard Butler's up in Hayden Lake, but there's actually an Identity Christian compound in Hayden, in Sandpoint, a city of 5,200. That, by the way, the information came from the Coalition for Human Dignity in Portland, accessed in the anti-fascist British magazine, The Searchlight. That's my source. I believe the guy's name was Dave Barwell, but I'm operating from memory.
Right.
One of the fascinating pieces of rumination in your book, Stephen, concerns your reflections when the Oklahoma City bombing finally succeeded in doing something nobody else had been able to do, or nothing else had been able to do, pushing the O.J. Simpson case off of page one.
Well, what was interesting was that when I was originally approached by my source, I was told, I mean, and this is almost a direct quote, you wrote about neo-Nazis 10 years ago, and you wrote about them as a fringe group. I mean, they definitely were. Nine guys formed a circle up in Washington State and decided to create a white power revolution in America. And they did, in fact, wreak a lot of havoc before they were finished. But it was a fringe group, and I was told that these elements are no longer operating on the fringes. They're a lot closer to mainstream society and respectability. And I, frankly, I mean, I haven't tracked all this stuff that much over the last 10 years. I went on to other things and read other books. And I was not that aware of it. As the Simpson case unfolded, it became very clear what I was being told, was that somebody with a white supremacist agenda, like a Mark Furman, could hold our entire society hostage by, you know, very small actions and a very few words could hold an entire society hostage and make them believe something, even if it weren't true.
We should stress once again that Mark Furman has not been charged, convicted in connection with any crime, simply for formal legal purposes.
But I had been told that that was possible.
Oh, yeah.
Then the book that I quoted at length in when I wrote my first book, Talk to Death, was this book called The Turner Diaries, which was a white supremacist fantasy novel about a white power revolution that occurs, I think it was in 1991, I think it was when the revolution was supposed to occur. This was written, I believe, back in the 70s. And blacks, Jews, Hispanics, women, homosexuals are all sort of slaughtered, and these white Christians take over the country and set everything to rights and live happily ever after, basically. And it was a fantasy novel, as I said, but when the people who killed Alan Berg, their blueprint for doing what they did came right out of this book, and so they turned the fantasy into reality and had plans to kill blacks and other Jews, etc. That was fairly remarkable and alarming and astounding in and of itself for that particular book at that particular time. Then I was told that Furman was connected to some of these same people, which was further astounding and remarkable. Then when the Murrah building was blown up in Oklahoma City a year ago, Timothy McVeigh was arrested, and the book that he had on his person at that time was The Turner Diaries. And some of the same people that he was associated with, and again, he has not been convicted of these crimes, but again, some of the same people that he was associated with were the names that had appeared in the book I had written 10 years earlier. So are all of these things connected? I'm not prepared to say that, but the remark that I was told at the start of my involvement in the Simpson case, that these elements have moved much closer into the mainstream. Furman was a cop. This guy was in the military. It really gives you a great deal to think about.
There is a tactic that has been formally expressed by various Nazi spokespersons, not only in the United States but in Europe, of the necessity for infiltrating the police and the military in order to acquire, quote, specialized knowledge and abilities, unquote. This to be used for the purposes of formally overthrowing the, quote, bourgeois state, unquote. The rhetoric of left revolutionaryism is sometimes co-opted by Nazi elements, even going back to the Hitler period when he called his group the German National Socialist Workers' Party in order to attract some disaffected leftists, at least in the initial phase. I would also note that the National Vanguard Books that puts out the Turner Diaries also has a couple of other books out, one called Serpent's Walk, about a Nazi takeover of the United States in the middle of the 21st century by descendants of the SS who have infiltrated the U.S. Army. And at the end of World War II, we did take in a great many Third Reich veterans to use in our intelligence system and military and in our rocket and other military sciences. Interestingly enough, this Nazi takeover, this projected Nazi takeover, takes place after underground elements of the SS build up a capital organization and buy into the U.S. media, using it to sway Americans in a Nazi direction. There was an account in a 1990 book about by an informant, an apparent participant in the order, a guy named Martinez, that he alleges that, quote, German families, unquote, in Latin America had helped channel some money to the order's activities. I don't know if there's been any overt confirmation of that. I would also note that National Vanguard Books has a book called Hunter, about a Nazi assassin that goes around killing people of color and interracial couples in particular, oddly enough. You know, whether there's any connection, I can't say. It certainly is significant or interesting, and I wouldn't altogether dismiss the possibility that it might have some significance. One of the things that you note in your book, Stephen, and that I think your source expressed quite eloquently, is that one of the central aspects of this case was not about, that this case was not about justice, but it was about winning. And I think, to a certain extent, if I'm interpreting your take on the various elements involved in this, the media certainly, the prosecution certainly, the defense possibly, and I think, you know, Mr. and Mrs. America and all the ships at sea possibly, that really winning took precedence over truth and justice. And I wonder if I could ask you to perhaps develop that a little further.
Well, I think that was the disturbing thing about the whole involvement for me. I began with the premise that if a blood test would reveal the truth of at least one aspect of this, then let's run the blood test. Let's get that information to somebody and get them to run the blood test and get some answers. I mean, there's rumor, innuendo, and everything else, but that was the only provable thing in this case as far as I could tell. I went to the defense, as I said a long time ago, in August of 94, and the very first thing Carl Douglas told me when I was talking with him is, he said, "You don't understand any of this." He said, "There is nobody in this case cares about anything except furthering their careers." He said, "That's what you don't get in this situation. You know, we're doing this in public. We're going to be judged publicly, and nobody is going to risk anything or is going to risk their career for anything of the nature of that you're suggesting. In other words, let's find out what really happened." And at the time, I don't think I believed him. I thought, well, he's just a cynical lawyer, or he's just trying to get rid of me or something like that. I really believe now that, you know, he was just simply telling me the truth, the obvious truth. The defense was not particularly interested in doing anything except getting Simpson off. The prosecution was not interested in any information that did not square with their airtight theory that they started with. And that, I mean, I tried to talk to Chris Darden several times, and he would not talk to me. The people who came forward long before the trial started, who had had firsthand experience of Furman's racism, tried to talk to them, and they wouldn't listen to them. They clearly were not involved in a search for the truth. I thought long and hard about going to Judge Ito at some point and dealing with him, and I went to two or three lawyers and talked to them about it, and they said he'll never take independent testimony from you. It's not his job, and it's just not going to do any good. I tried my best to go to people in the media and to get them to work with me to investigate some of this information, people with real resources, the networks, for example. I couldn't get anywhere. I suppose if the story, my particular story, has any message to it, or a narrative to it, it is just a total loss of innocence, you know, that I thought there was somebody with some interest in finding out what happened in this case. And I just don't believe that. It's all about image. I mean, if you create a society that operates now on images and on celebrity and on frivolousness, to use your Edith Wharton example, and you go up against that, it's frightening. I mean, it's absolutely frightening that I think that we've come to this point. This is the only substantive conversation I've had about the book that I've written. Nobody wants to deal with it. Nobody wants to think that police may be a disruptive force in our society as well as a force to, you know, quell disorder. I mean, maybe we have a problem there. Nobody wants to believe that they're generating or perhaps deepening racial hatred and violence.
There is an old Turkish proverb, Stephen, that reminds me of the rejection that you experienced at the hands of the prosecution, the media, and others, and that is that he who tells the truth gets chased out of 9 villages. And I'm afraid that's has certainly been your experience, and I can't say as my experience pointing to the probability of O.J.'s innocence before the verdict, and then, of course, he was acquitted. It simply does not carry a whole lot of weight. I think people have been far more interested in confirmation than information in this case. They want their hopes, their beliefs, their prejudices, their hypotheses confirmed rather than examining information, which might lead in a different direction.
Right.
One of the things that continues to puzzle me, Stephen, is why the defense did not make better use of some of the information you gave them. They were prevented by Judge Ito from testing some of the samples for EDTA. And yet, for example, when F. Lee Bailey, or for that matter the other attorneys, were dealing with the issue of the planted glove, they never pointed to that blue plastic object on the other side of the fence. It would seem to me that a demonstration of that picture in connection with showing an LAPD evidence bag might have been quite compelling.
I don't understand all of those things myself. I told Carl Douglas when I began and I was trying to get this blood preservative theory off the ground, and I just kept saying to him, Carl, there's more at stake here than winning this trial. You know, if Simpson walks out of that courtroom and people think he's guilty, it's not going to serve him very well, and it's not going to serve race relations in this country, and it's not going to serve other things. And he just looked at me like I was from Mars. Like, it just, none of that matters, you know. And I think when the Furman tapes came along, they had what they perceived everything they needed to win, and they weren't going to try anything that was very risky. And as they always say, they don't have to prove anything. I mean, I think what I told Carl has ultimately proven to be the truth. I mean, they won. O.J. walked. He's a pariah. He can't do anything. I think there were larger issues at stake, but they're criminal defense lawyers. They don't care about any of that stuff. There's no vested public interest here if the people who work on behalf of the public don't do their jobs. So, I mean, they really are not maybe the heroes in the situation that one would like them to be. I wanted them to take the information and work with it. It was very, very, very hard to get them to listen to anything.
That's disturbing. Now, you mentioned that so far I have not heard from any media source anything about your book. A friend of mine mentioned it to me, and I have used my modest resources to try to publicize your book. What has been the media reaction? You said this is the first substantive conversation you've had in the media about this.
Well, first of all, most, you know, we just go back to the same cycle that we talk about. Most people in these circumstances who interview you haven't read what you've written. If you haven't read what I've written, there's no way to talk about it because it's complicated. It's not something that you can reduce to, you know, a handful of sentences and say, this is what happened. I mean, I went through a year-long experience of trying to get somebody to pay attention to what I thought was relevant. So that's where you start from. I mean, we've created this situation in which you can't, generally speaking, have the kinds of conversations that we're having right now. And there has been virtually no response. I mean, I can give you another example from Los Angeles when these crimes were committed on June 12, 1994. Simpson took his ride 5 days later on the 17th. A few days after that, a man named Peter Bozanich, who was one of Gil Garcetti's lieutenants, main lieutenants at that time, and was set in on all the high-level strategy sessions, what are we going to do in the Simpson case? He came forward, and he told Garcetti right then, he said, this evidence doesn't make sense. If you look at it, it just doesn't add up. There's no blood around that glove. How did the glove get there? Where are the footprints? How did this happen? And he went on, and he said other things. His reward for his behavior was to be demoted to the area here known as Compton, which is not a very nice place. They got rid of him. I went to media people here, and I gave Mr. Bozanich my book. He read it. He said, yeah. He said, I believe everything that's in there. And I went to the media here and tried to get this publicized, and they don't want anything to do with it. They don't want new information, and they don't want to upset the assumptions that they hold very dear to themselves.
That is very sad indeed. Stephen, we're almost out of time.
Yep.
I'd just like to get a brief reaction from you. I think in many ways the O.J. Simpson case could be said to correspond to the Dreyfus case in late 19th century France, and I think that any future treatment of this should go beyond any possible individual criminal guilt on the part of white supremacists or whoever, and to examine the sociological and political aspects of this terrible event.
I think that in its largest aspects, you know, there are three or four key points. We do in our racial subdivisions, we still have totally different experiences and don't see the world at all the same way, and racism is a part of us. I mean, if you can deny it, you can try and shove it under the rug, but it's there and it has to be confronted on both an individual level and on a social level. The people who have bought into the myth of this case need to examine their own racial fears. I don't care what color they are. They need to take a look at it. That's number one. That's the most important thing.
We're almost out of time, Steve.
Number two, the media. You must question what it presents if you think it's reality. It is a grotesque distortion in many cases of what is real, and people have to confront that. And third, you can never assume that you know everything. You just can't. All it took to solve this case were a few open minds, and they just weren't there.
All righty. Well, Stephen Singular, I've been mispronouncing your name. I got in the habit of doing this for weeks before I got a chance to speak to you. Stephen Singular, spelled just like Singular, the author of Legacy of Deception, Dove Books, copyright 1995, soft cover edition. Stephen, thank you so much for writing this book. Thank you for the courage that you've demonstrated and the integrity you've demonstrated in pursuing your lonely quest. And let's hope that at some point this contributes substantively to our understanding of this event.
Well, thank you very much.
And thanks so much for your efforts.
Thanks.
A good night now. That concludes our discussion with Stephen Singular. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening, and good night.